Hello, I'm Dr. Robert Bastian. Our subject is a specific kind of breathing problem caused by narrowing in the breathing passage beginning just below the vocal cords and sometimes down into the upper windpipe. And the narrowing is caused by inflammation, probably autoimmune. So we have breathing trouble caused by narrowing with the narrowing caused by inflammation. The common name of the disorder is idiopathic subglottic stenosis. Now, I think there are actually clues to the cause of this disorder, but idiopathic means unknown cause, subglottic means below the vocal cords, stenosis means narrowing. So, idiopathic subglottic stenosis. If you want to see a lot of photos of the actual lesions, go to Laryngopedia on the internet and type in search terms like stenosis, subglottic stenosis, idiopathic subglottic stenosis, and Formfrost-Wegener's granulomatosis. Well, where exactly are the subglottis and upper trachea? When you look at a person's neck from in front of them, those areas, the subglottis and the high trachea, correlate to just below the Adam's apple or the larynx. This lowest part of the Adam's apple is typically fairly low in the neck, almost to where the chest starts. Well, what does idiopathic subglottic stenosis do to people who have it? In biggest picture terms, it causes noisy and difficult breathing. Something like this. I remember one patient who said, "I sound like the north wind." Others say, "I can't keep up with my young children without getting winded and making that harsh noise." Some even notice walking the mall can be difficult. Others have particular trouble in the morning, especially in winter when indoor air is dry and mucus tends to accumulate in the narrow segment. So they do a lot of coughing to clear that mucus that wants to stick in that area. Now, many doctors are content to call this idiopathic, unknown cause, and to leave it there. For me, that's not very satisfying because the narrowing always has a red, inflamed appearance, and it looks exactly like the narrowing we see with the disorder called Wegener's granulomatosis. Now, that disorder is called granulomatosis with polyangiitis. And I'm going to just use Wegener's from now on in this presentation. So without being able to prove it, I think that idiopathic subglottic stenosis is actually caused by a mild case, a limited case, of Wegener's granulomatosis. Now, a small aside here, for whatever it's worth, many years ago, I studied a smaller group of about 30 patients I had back then, in order to put forward the idea that ISS is simply a frustrated or incomplete form of Wegener's, just for others to consider. I used the results of lab tests of inflammation, biopsy results, and careful comparison of pictures of the stenosis of both full-blown Wegener's and this idiopathic subglottic stenosis, comparing them to show how similar they were. Well, the upshot of my study was that the findings were suggestive but not definitive, and so it was not accepted for publication. It seemed that the reviewers at that time thought that this disorder, idiopathic subglottic stenosis, was the result of acid reflux, even though there were no direct or indirect symptoms of acid reflux and no signs of inflammation in the pharynx or upper larynx, where you would expect to see inflammation with reflux, but the inflammation was only in this extremely specific place, just below the vocal cord. So I don't think that was highly satisfying experience. Now let's talk for a moment about full-blown Wegener's. That disorder tends to be a more systemic, meaning whole body, and less focal, or not so much a one-location disorder, but a several-location disorder. Wegener's is seen fairly equally in men and women, The inflammation often attacks several places, the nose and sinuses, the subglottis, the lungs, the kidneys are some prime examples. For Wegeners, a clinical diagnosis is allowed if two of three areas are involved, the sinus, the lung, and the kidney. If you have two of the three of those, then you can clinically diagnose Wegeners. And if a blood test called the ANCA, anti-neutrophil cytoplasmic antibody, is positive. And finally, if study under the microscope of a biopsy of involved tissue somewhere in the body reveals a finding called vasculitis. So that's full-blown Wegeners. Sinus, lungs, kidney, positive ANCA, biopsy showing vasculitis. By contrast, in people with ISS, or what I believe to be a limited expression of Wegeners, the population is almost all female, almost all women. The inflammation attacks only the subglottis and in a few, the septum, in the nose, or sinus. Lungs and kidneys are always normal and unaffected. And in addition, the ANCA is negative or sometimes a little borderline. And so far, I've not had a biopsy show vasculitis or polyangiitis. Instead, invariably, the biopsy result comes back as acute and chronic inflammation. Now, a nonspecific lab test for inflammation, the erythrocyte sedimentation rate, ESR, is often positive, however. So all of these taken together don't quite satisfy many doctors, and so they think it is not a limited expression of Wegeners. Yet for me, the appearance, the lesion, the actual visualization of this inflamed, narrowed area, if you put them side by side, they can look almost identical. And of course, the SED rate is up, ESR is up, and some patients go on and get some nasal crusting and inflammation. And so that, to me, is sufficient to at least raise the idea that this may be a limited expression of Wegener's granulomatosis. Well, now let's move back to just idiopathic subglottic stenosis, or if you will, the limited expression of Wegeners. Some additional observations. We've already said it causes noisy and effortful breathing with any significant exertion. That's the full-blown Wegeners. I forgot to say, the individual is usually fairly young or middle-aged, though occasionally older at presentation. They usually say that for no particular reason, they just began to notice a sense of mildly noisy breathing, and across months or years, it has gotten slowly worse. And it's common that the person, by the time I see them anyway, has been tested and treated for asthma or other conditions, and then finally someone does a scan or sends to an ENT, and the lesion is seen, the narrowing is seen directly. And now we have better information. In a few, there's already been a tracheotomy placed by the time I see them, though tracheotomy is rarely, if ever, necessary when doctors have experience with this disorder. Now, if a person sees an ENT first, who listens to that and how long it takes to fill, and who finds the inflammatory stenosis, I personally think, at least at the beginning, a really simple workup suffices. And the idea of this simple workup is to rule in or rule out full-blown Wegeners. So we do an ANCA blood test, anti-neutrophil cytoplasmic antibody, we do an erythrocyte sedimentation rate, ESR, and we do a chest X-ray and a urinalysis in idiopathic subglottic stenosis or limited Wegeners. All of these are normal, with the exception that occasionally the ANCA will be borderline and often the ESR, the SED rate, is high. So now we know we don't have full-blown, officially diagnosed Wegeners. Still, we move on to the next step, which is a trip to the operating room, and I'll explain what happens in the operating room in a minute. But for now, suffice it to say that the purpose of the trip to the operating room is biopsy to get tissue and dilation to make to help the patient breathe better. So biopsy of the stenosis area is done only the first time dilation is performed, and the pathologist's reading is always the very same. They say acute and chronic inflammation, non-specific signs of inflammation that don't give us a named diagnosis. So for me, the strongest element of the diagnosis is the appearance of the lesion. It's so typical. You see them, these kinds of stenosis. It doesn't look like the stenosis of a breathing tube scar. It looks like form-thrust Wegeners. It looks like limited Wegeners. It looks like idiopathic subglottic stenosis, however you want to designate this problem. And again, you can check out several examples of the appearance on Laryngopedia on the internet, and you will see lots of pictures of it. So again, to review, we have breathing trouble caused by narrowing below the vocal cords, which is in turn caused by inflammation. The diagnosis of Wegeners, the official Wegeners, has been ruled out. The full-blown has been ruled out, and so we call it idiopathic subglottic stenosis, or if you think as I do, you call it limited Wegeners. Okay, so back to a summary of where we stand. We have a person who has presented with noisy breathing, the narrowing has been identified, and she has had the initial humble workup of ANCA, chest x-ray, urinalysis, and erythrocyte sedimentation rate. Now we're actually going to talk about the initial dilation and the one and only biopsy they will likely ever need across coming years. So how is the dilation and that procedure done? Well, it's done in a simple, during a simple outpatient procedure, and it's done under a brief general anesthetic, and it's in, an outpatient setting. The actual procedure takes about 20 minutes, but with the arrival, the check-in, the changing clothes, the placement of an IV, meeting the surgeon and the anesthesiologist, returning to full alertness and changing back into street clothes for the ride home and so forth, it's probably a 3-hour visit, but again, a 20-minute procedure. Now, once the patient is fully anesthetized using what is called mask ventilation, not a breathing tube, but just a mask, a laryngoscope is inserted by the surgeon or the ENT to view the inside of the larynx and beyond. Through the lumen, the passageway of the laryngoscope, the surgeon uses Jackson dilators or a balloon dilator to enlarge the airway. Now it's easy to pass a breathing tube right through the laryngoscope, and then we continue the anesthesia process and we hyperoxygenate. Then, with the larynx in full and stable view, the patient deeply asleep, hyperoxygenated, the breathing tube is removed briefly 2 or 3 times and reinserted, removed 2 or 3 times to allow the following steps. So in that brief minute or two that the tube is out, the completion of dilation, so larger dilators if needed, and then the biopsy, that one and only biopsy ever needed, and then triamcinolone, 40 milligrams per ml, that's a long-acting, locally injected form of steroid, is injected circumferentially into the area of the narrowing and the inflammation. And then finally, a medication, an anti-scarring medication called mitomycin C, is applied topically with a cottonoid sponge for 2 to 3 minutes. At the conclusion of the procedure, the anesthesia agents are stopped, and after several minutes, the breathing tube removed, and the patient awakens, breathing dramatically better. Sometimes the difference is so great that it makes patients emotional. They actually have tears of joy right on the table as they're awakening. Now, we've had our first workup, that humble workup I mentioned earlier, and we've had our dilation and our biopsy, and the patient is now happy and breathing well. Well, what comes next for this happy person breathing well? After all, the patient isn't likely to need repeat dilation for 6 months to 2 years or even longer. Is there anything further that should be done? Well, at this point, it's a good idea for the patient to see a rheumatologist. That's a specialist in autoimmune disorders like rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's and so forth. And it helps to find a rheumatologist particularly interested in this population, and if possible, to send all patients with this problem to the same person in order to concentrate his or her experience with this rare disorder. Now, you have the person see the rheumatologist because he or she might add new ideas. The whole field of immunotherapy is exploding, and so you want to make sure that your patient has the latest ideas from the rheumatologist. Now, some patients want to try long-term Bactrim or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Others try low-dose methotrexate. Some use a low dose of steroid. I'm not sure if any of these lesser treatments help, and actually many patients don't do any of them. They just wait until they need their next dilation. And that's because the interval between treatments can be quite long, and so taking that medicine every day when they're not going to need a dilation for a year, in some, it's not worth it. And determining whether the added treatment, the methotrexate or whatever, is helpful is hard because there are so few people. I think we have 70 or 80, and with the long interval between recurrences, it's hard to develop statistical power. Now, keep in mind that if the diagnosis were full-blown Wegener's, there are other medicines, and they are things like adalimumab or Humira, or rituximab or cyclophosphamide, and those don't tend to be used unless you have full-blown systemic disease, Wegener's. One exception I know of is a young woman in whom rituximab was used, and she doesn't have the full-blown Wegener's. But anyway, now another comment about the time that passes before the next dilation. In my experience, a typical interval might be give or take a year. It's very uncommon to need a subsequent dilation in less than 4 months, and it's also unusual to go more than 3 or 4 years, except when a person has had this disorder for many, many years, and in some cases the disease process seems to go quiet. We call it burning out. And perhaps the immune system calms down as a person gets older. Well, how is it decided when the next dilation should occur? The answer is that the patient decides. And the patient decides this based upon their breathing experience. They know better than anyone else when breathing has become a little more work, and they know when the effort is sufficient to motivate them to schedule another dilation. Or they begin to have more difficulty clearing secretions, and they notice they're coughing more in the morning and so forth. So it's based on the patient's experience. A second or subsequent dilation is not based upon examination findings or blood work or pulmonary function tests or peak flow meter readings or x-rays, but it's instead, again, on that patient experience. When the patient comes back and says, you know what, I think I'm ready, or I'm getting ready, or soon will be ready, the examiner, the clinician, uses that evaluation of time to fill that and a visual examination of the narrowing to confirm. And by the way, look for an upcoming video about evaluation of airway using your ears and the noise and the time that it takes to fill. Well, to summarize again, up to this point, we have breathing difficulty caused by narrowing, caused in turn by inflammation, probably autoimmune, and the initial workup has been with ANCA, ESR, chest x-ray, and urinalysis, and biopsy. And thereafter, we simply dilate When the patient feels the need, we inject steroid and we paint with the anti-scarring mitomycin C, and then we repeat as needed some months or years later. Well, with all of this as background, are there any side issues or sidebars we should talk about? Just a few things. You may encounter papers describing tracheal resection and reanastomosis. These are done, we've done many of those, after intubation injuries, quiet scars, standard scars. I personally am a little reluctant to do this for an inflammatory condition, especially since it so often includes the lower half of the cricoid cartilage, which makes it a little more difficult, slightly more risky. It certainly can be considered. What about newer approaches? Well, for us, they include office-based steroid injection, and you can see some photos of that approach on Laryngopedia, and office-based laser, and you can see examples of that as well. We are currently doing a small number of motivated patients in this way, so I am not sure yet if this can substitute for the traditional procedure in the OR that I've described already. Well, a person might ask, well, do I seek this kind of evaluation and workup and treatment from an ENT or a pulmonologist? Well, a busy laryngologist who knows about this disorder can accomplish this very easily. That is, an ENT who does direct laryngoscopies in the operating room routinely for other reasons is equipped by that experience to add this variation on that common procedure for them, even if he or she has few patients. They understand the disorder and the steps that I've outlined above. On the other hand, there may be a pulmonologist here and there with a large population of this problem, and that person may be very procedure-oriented, and so it's not. It is possible that pulmonologists somewhere would be the person to do this in their local community. Now, one small comment about availability of the dilation procedure. The procedure needs to be available on demand and without delay due to the quality of life impact it has on the patient. Especially in the winter months, mucus tends to accumulate at that speed bump of the stenosis. And most veterans to this procedure, people who've had this done a few times, can sense when the airway is beginning to narrow, and they can almost estimate when they might be ready for a subsequent dilation. So they call ahead and they get it scheduled. Now, someone might ask about do people go between full-blown Wegeners and limited Wegeners and back? And the answer is that I've seen the official full-blown Wegeners go into remission, but I've never seen idiopathic subglottic stenosis move over to full-blown Wegeners. Another comment, I've mentioned briefly nose and sinus. There is a group of these patients with ISS who definitely develop a similar inflammatory condition of the nasal passage. Specifically, the septum becomes granular, crusted, and bleeds easily. The septum is the part of the nose that divides it into a right and a left half up inside. So that septum can become granular, crusted, and it can bleed easily. But even in that group, I have not yet been able to diagnose Wegener's granulomatosis based on the usual criteria. Well, there's a big summary of this rare disorder and a word of encouragement. Fortunately, patients who have this problem, initially it's a little shock and something to get their minds around that they have this chronic recurring problem. But after they get into it a few times, patients pretty universally view this as an annoyance more than as an ordeal. The dilation procedure is pretty straightforward and it's efficient. And they live very regular, normal lives with the exception of these little episodes of care. There's no effect on general health. There's no effect on longevity, just an annoying little medical interlude here and there in their lives. Thank you for listening.